Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome back to City of Champions Radio here on Blog Talk Radio. I am your host, Matt Geica, also the co-editor and lead writer at City of Champions, found at cityofchampionsports.com. A reminder that you can find City of Champions on Facebook and Twitter. And also, if you are interested in contributing unique and compelling Pittsburgh sports content, we're always looking for contributors. And so you can reach out to me on Twitter if you like to get in touch and join the City of Champions family. We would love to have you. We had another two-episode week last week on City of Champs Radio, including TJ McElhone joined me to talk some ideas for Penguins trades in the offseason, which is always fun to discuss with him. He's got a pretty creative mind for that, and we appreciate the positive feedback we got on that program. It's another two-show week. Later this week, I'll have Dan Cifo, the sports assistant editor at the La Trobe, Pennsylvania Bulletin, and also a Steelers freelancer at DK on Pittsburgh Sports. So looking forward to having Daniel on the show. He's a first-timer. And I'm also looking forward to welcoming aboard today's featured guest. He is the weekend host at Trib Live Radio, which you can find at triblive.com. He's an aficionado of both soccer and golf, two subjects that I care about very much and I'm very interested in. So I anticipate our conversation this afternoon. His name is Mike Graw. Mike, thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, it'd be great to be here, Matt. Thanks for having me on.
No problem, sir. First of all, if you could let the listeners know how you got your start at Trib Live Radio. You've been on there as long as I have been listening to it. And tell us a little bit more about your sporting background, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, I've actually been very fortunate to end up with some of the opportunities that I have because I really don't have any sort of background in journalism or broadcasting or anything like that. I actually got my start when 1250 ESPN used to have the top fan contest and they would look for on-air talent, and One of my friends suggested, yeah, you should go do that. And I ended up signing up for the contest the second year and won it and ended up starting doing some work at ESPN Radio. And ever since then, I got to know Mike Parker at Trib Live Radio. And since they started that up, I've been able to continue my love of just thinking and talking sports. And I like to think that when I try to do my shows, that I rise above and look at a little different angle than just the typical fandom. I like to look at deeper issues within the sport, and I get a chance to do that on Trib Live Radio, and it's always been more of a hobby than my life calling and profession, but it's a thing that I have a lot of fun doing and really enjoy doing, so having this opportunity to do it here with you today makes it all the better.
Well, thanks for filling me and the listeners in. I'm always interested in people's backstories and how they get into this business or, I guess, any other business. But you and I have gotten to know each other a little bit over the past several weeks as you are the host of the pregame show for Riverhound Soccer on Trib Live Radio. And whether it be leading up to a road game, you do that in the morning on Saturday or in the evenings or in the lead up to games from Highmark Stadium. It has been enjoyable talking about the beautiful game with you, and of course seeing all the Riverhounds guests you have on helping to promote Pittsburgh's pro soccer team. So it's been a lot of fun to be a part of that. Let's start with some soccer, why don't we? You seem to definitely have a passion for what you call association football and what a lot of people over on this side of the pond call soccer, but I do like the different ways you refer to it. But how did you first pick up an interest of the sport, because it really wasn't the easiest sport to follow over, like I said, on this side of the Atlantic Ocean for quite some time. It's different now, of course. It's much more accessible. But for a while there, it was really limited to the true believers, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I got to fully admit, I wasn't one of those true believers. This wasn't a sport I grew up with or had access to or had a passion for during my youth. It really came in my early 20s, some friends in college who started to introduce it to me more. And then afterwards, my real love for watching televised, you know, for really embracing the sport of soccer on television game. After college, I was working in a job where my boss was a big soccer fan. And it was shortly after I finished school, and it was Euro 2004 was going on. And he was a big soccer fan. I started working at this company, and he would say, hey, let's duck out of work early and go watch this soccer match. And for me at 24 years old, I said, well, heck yeah, I'll leave work early and go watch this soccer match if the bar tab's on you. Well, yeah, that sounds great. I don't know anything about soccer. And I absolutely fell in love with the game, especially it was just this whole new world of things to learn about that I hadn't been exposed to. And it was learning about all the different competitions and, you know, promotion and relegation and the way that whole system works, and cups mixed in with league schedules, mixed in with continental schedules, mixed in with your international team schedule. It was this amazing machine that never stopped. And not only that, but I just love the visual product of the game. Of a game starts at noon, it's going to be over by 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I get bored during commercials. I have all the commercials during NFL games drive me crazy. I love this contained product where there's always something going and the sport never stops. And it's just something that I immediately embraced and fell in love with. And it's only grown ever since that time to the point where it is the sport the professional sport that I probably follow most closely. It's just still this whole, no matter how much you learn about the game, there's always going to be another team or another league or another competition to find out about. The world of it is just so infinite. It really just caught my attention, and it's still growing. I thought maybe for a time that it was just going to be a fad, but it's certainly been long enough, and it's still, I'm not sated in my desire to learn about this game, that it's more than just a fad or a phase for me. It's something that's going to stick around for a while.
I don't know if you watch the Men in Blazers show on NBC Sports Network or if you've ever listened to their podcast, but yeah, Raj and Dave always talk about how soccer has been referred to as the sport of the future for the last 50 years in America, but I really do feel like it has gained that foothold, and it's kind of incredible, actually, and I think I give credit to the internet, to modern media, making all of this a lot more accessible than it used to be. I remember when I was a lot younger and my brother played soccer. We both played, but he was much better than I was, and we always would travel around to his youth games and as he got older into the high school level. But we would watch I think it was the Premier League highlight show or something like that on, I want to say, Fox Sports Pittsburgh on the weekdays afternoons. It was like a window into a totally different world. Now it's kind of all mixed in the sporting universe, and I think you see big entities like NBC Sports Network, like ESPN cover soccer like they cover basically any other sport. So that much has been interesting. And I can definitely relate to what you're talking about, the lack of media timeouts in this world of modern sport, where it seems like the action is almost secondary to the advertisements. It is refreshing just to watch 45 minutes of continuous action. So I think that's a major selling point when it comes to the sport,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, you take a quick break, you get something to eat, you go to the bathroom, before you know it, halftime's over, another 45 minutes, you're done for the day. It's a wonderful viewing experience. And another area that it has an advantage it has over other major North American sports is it's still the best of the best is played in Europe, and watching games in Europe, it doesn't interfere with watching any, maybe there's a college football Saturday or the first part of an NFL Sunday where you might miss part of one game. But other than that, it's a completely independent time. You don't have to sacrifice another sport in order to embrace a love of soccer.
That could be a big key, too. You watch it in the morning, and there you go. You move on with your day for the most part. Mm-hmm. But I want to talk a little bit about something you brought up a moment ago. The system of promotion and relegation, it's very unique. It's kind of hard to get your mind around as a North American sports fan. But on the other side of the ocean, it's given as a part of the landscape. And we're coming up on figuring out who is going to be relegated from the English Premier League and who's going to be promoted from the championship level. And that's about as big of a moment as you can get for a club, just because it's not just wins and losses at stake, but potentially tens, maybe even hundreds of millions of dollars down the line are up for grabs if you can move up a level, or you could lose that much money if you move down a level and you can't get back up. So, number one, what are your feelings on that system? And number two, is it ever feasible to see it come over here, even just in soccer and perhaps even stretching out to some of the other major sports? Can it happen, I guess? Can that type of a system expand to other areas?
Well, number one, of course, I love it for this sport. And kind of the answer for number two of why I don't see it happening in the U.S. for a long time is just because of a very basic difference in the setup. MLS has already gone down the road of having a league that hands out franchises. And in order to have a promotion relegation system, it can't be a league-based entity that then hands out franchises to clubs. It's got to be clubs that then organize into forming leagues. In American sports, it's all league-based. In the European countries, the association football leagues are all club-based, and that is the core organizing principle. So the toothpaste might already be out of the tube for a system like that in North America, or it would take a drastic revamping of the entire way MLS and the other leagues like USL and NASL do business. It would just take an entirely different reorganization. Now, it's not impossible if the number of clubs grows to a certain level that a system like that needs to come into place, but the current setup of MLS now, you know, handing out these franchises and expansion teams the way that they are, that already kind of puts the option of relegation and promotion out of the rear window already at this point, even though it's still only a 20-year-old league. They still have time to grow and figure things out. It's just hard for me to see that in its current setup for quite some time. But the reason, the promotion and relegation, it means everything to these clubs. You mentioned the amount of money that is going to be in play. It's Norwich and Brentford, if I'm not mistaken, now playing in the English second division championship game at Wembley Stadium. They call it the most valuable game in sports. The money you get from the Premier League day one, $156 million is the team share figure for next year. That's what it's worth for one of those two teams to win this one game in Wembley Stadium to be the third team promoted. And on the other hand, you look at what Hull City or Newcastle or Sunderland, whoever ends up going down, really in all likelihood Hull City, because they got to go out and beat Manchester United on Sunday for the day off. But $50 million going to grow in new years as their television contracts become more and more valuable. But it keeps you playing for something no matter what. There's no tanking in the Premier League. The worst thing that can happen is you finish last. We have the NBA draft lottery going on tonight. The Philadelphia 76ers have had a five-year plan of being as bad as possible all leading up to this one night to try and hoard lottery picks. What good does that do anybody? What good can that do for the professionals, supposed professionals that are on that team that know they're being brought there for the sole purpose of losing? Losing holds no value on any level whatsoever in any world soccer league or organization. That's what makes every match matter so much, from week one to week 38 in the Premier League, or you know, whatever number of matches you play in your specific league. Every match holds equal weight, and the worst thing that can possibly happen is finishing at the bottom and being the worst, because the financial difference from getting bumped down a league is such a massive incentive for any club. It's the worst thing you can happen, whereas in some of our sports, losing is actually rewarded.
It was certainly rewarded for the Buffalo Sabres of the NHL, too, where in a draft, when there are two franchise talents available, you finish last overall. You're guaranteed, at least the way the system was this year. It won't be the case next year, but since they finished last, they were guaranteed to get one of the top two, and they ended up getting number two, but it's still going to be a pretty big boon for that franchise. It's not always easy to turn it around, and I think maybe in Pittsburgh we get the feeling that it's easier than it might be. The Pens happened to be bad just when two real franchise centers were available in Crosby and Malkin, and Pens even lost the draft lottery in 04 and got Malkin, so that was also a pretty tremendous windfall. But yes, it just further illustrates the difference between our sports over here and the sport of soccer. But I want to talk a little bit more about American soccer, and in particular the team right here in town, the Pittsburgh Riverhounds. And it's been great having you and Josh Taylor down on the south side, helping to promote the Hounds and get people out to support the beautiful game at Highmark Stadium. But what are your thoughts long term? What do the Hounds have to do to gain that foothold in Pittsburgh and become that fourth sport, that fourth pro sport that captures people's imaginations and perhaps leads to an opportunity to bump up a level or two in the U.S. soccer hierarchy, maybe looking 5-10 years down the line?
Well, of course, the any answer to that question is going to be they need to start winning with more regularity. And I know that that's the easy answer, but it's a simple fact. If they want people to pay attention, you know, it's already got the disadvantage of not being MLS, not being – I mean, there are some MLS teams that still have a little trouble drawing in non-major markets, but it's not the top league, and fans know that, and they want to go see – I mean – people in Pittsburgh don't show up to watch the Pitt Panthers at Heinz Field because they have a superior product the next day in the Pittsburgh Steelers. And this is a football crazy town, and they still can't get, you know, 30,000 people to regularly come to watch the major college football team in town because there is a superior product being played the next day. So until we start seeing Pittsburgh has an organization that is at the highest level of the sport, it's going to be hard to gain mass interest in the bandwagon fan that would truly turn it into, you know, a Goliath in the Pittsburgh sports landscape. But for the time being, I think that there are enough soccer fans, as we've mentioned. The sport is just growing in popularity and visibility and fandom, especially in, you know, people under 30 and, you know, that are really just coming to the game and being exposed to it and enjoying it as a spectator sport. You need to let those people know that it's still a quality product and a great live viewing experience, and not to dismiss it just because it's not the top level. I think that that's a problem for some people in Pittsburgh. They don't want to see anything but the top level, and they know that the USL, even though it's still incorrectly referred to as the third tier of U.S. soccer, I think any objective viewing would say that it's moved well past NASL into being the second highest level, even though, as we've discussed before, level naming doesn't matter if you don't have promotion and relegation. But until that, I think that's the thing that's holding them back, getting people that are soccer fans to know that it might not be what you watch on Saturdays or on weekdays in Champions League from your couch. It's still a very high-paced, skilled, quality viewing experience. And if the hardcore soccer fans would show up and give it a chance, that would be a great boon for the team. But until they start winning more regularly and maybe, you know, show those ambitions to play at the highest levels, that's what it's going to take before it firmly entrenches itself as a fourth major sport in Pittsburgh.
And I also think the fact that under Mark Steffens, it's playing a more aggressive style. They're much more entertaining, I believe, than they were the last couple of years. Whether or not that leads to a significant improvement in the standings, I guess we'll find out at the end of the year. But I have enjoyed watching this edition of the club more than I had the last 2 years. And I think that's also a selling point. If you have the winning and the exciting brand go hand in hand, I think that's the best of both worlds. One last thing on soccer before I definitely want to get to golf. I don't get to talk golf that much with people, so I'm going to take advantage of this opportunity with you. But you brought up the fact that soccer has your regular league schedule, and also you play these other cups, maybe interleague play, if you will, and matching glares with teams from other leagues and other parts of the country and the continent and the world. The Hounds have a game coming up of that nature tomorrow night, Wednesday night at Highmark Stadium, when they begin the U.S. Open Cup tournament, and that is the third longest running such competition in worldwide soccer and the longest in America, and essentially any team can enter that and win that if you are good enough at, say, if you're a lower-level pro team or an amateur team, you can win your league, and then the next year you have a shot at the U.S. Open Cup. So the Hounds will play the West Virginia Chaos of the level below, the PDL, coming up here on Wednesday. But also on the world stage, we have UEFA Champions League coming to an end. And Saturday the 6th of June, I should say, a couple weeks down the road. But it's coming to a head. FC Barcelona against Juventus. So Spain against Italy. Those two leagues will send their best representatives to match up coming up here. And I want to get your perspective and your thought on who might have the edge. I think soccer fans win for sure with this matchup, but yeah. At the same time, there's got to be in the end a winner and a loser. So what do you think is going to play out on the pitch there in a couple of weeks?
I've been having competing thoughts on this going since the semifinals and the final were decided. I'm thrilled that it worked out like this. As much as Barcelona and Real Madrid is a great story to have El Clasico in the Champions League final, it tends not to be a very entertaining game when those two teams get together, and Juventus is nothing but entertainment. And I'm done. I promised myself that I'm done underestimating Juventus after what they did against Real Madrid. I gave them virtually no shot going into that semifinal. They totally proved me wrong. They came out attacking, exciting. They didn't sit back and defend and hope to poach one. They took the game to Real Madrid and deservedly went through. Now, that being said, I can't fathom anybody being able to stop Neymar, Suarez, and Messi over 90 minutes in any circumstance. Those three have figured out how to play together. They're clicking so well. It's just an unstoppable force. It seems like they can decide, okay, we're going to get a goal now, and they go out and do it. And I think Juventus, who likes to play a back four, a diamond, and then two strikers up top, usually Carlos Tevez and Morata, who came back to haunt Real Madrid in the Champions League semifinal, I think it would be a huge mistake for them to trot out and try that same thing. Manchester City tried it in the Champions League, and Barcelona just picked them apart through the midfield. I think it would be a mistake to sacrifice that midfielder, but if you're going to have midfielders out there doing it, have little wrecking ball Arturo Vidal, who seems to end up on the ground after every touch, but he's all over the field and omnipresent and breaking things up and getting things started. Paul Pogba in the conversation for the third best player in the world. Maybe his last match in a Juventus uniform, if some of the transfer rumors are true there. And, of course, Andrea Pirlo, the coolest man in association football, sitting deep and pinging passes all over the field. So it's a good matchup. It's an interesting matchup. But Barcelona really just looks like an unstoppable force right now. And it pains me to say it because a couple of those guys are about as my least favorite athletes as you can imagine. There's nobody that I cheer harder against than Luis Suarez. Neymar's a pretty close second. I'm starting to think Messi, although he's the greatest player ever, is a bit of a bozo. It's just a team that I really have a hard time cheering for because I'm not a fan of the way Neymar conduct themselves on the field. So I'll be pulling for Juventus. Just have a feeling I'm going to be very disappointed when that final is over.
It's all coming to a conclusion. UEFA Champions League, the Premier League, soccer season abroad nearly over with, but just getting started here in America. So I'm sure we'll be talking about it down on the South Side and also whenever I call into your Saturday morning soccer show, which is always entertaining on Trib Live Radio. Now, Mike, I also know you talk some golf and your game for that, so let's go into the PGA. And I find myself really interested in how this golf season is going to play out. Of course, we're well into it. We've had, of course, the Masters play out. We've had a couple of World Golf Championships. We had the Players Championship just recently, a couple of weeks ago. And we're starting to see a trend here. The young trio of Rory McIlroy, of course, who I consider to still be the king of golf right now. But then you have Jordan Spieth winning the Masters by a near record margin. And Ricky Fowler taking home the Players' Championship. Still not a major winner, but that's about as close as you can get. And what a big-time performance from him late in that Sunday round down at Sawgrass and also in the playoff. But if you had to pick one of those three guys to really seize control this 2015 PGA Tour season, which one would you take?
Well, I think you'd be a crazy person not to take Rory McIlroy, especially what he did this past weekend and just finishing off the field and winning by seven shots. I'm sure he's still disappointed with his Masters performance and will rethink his strategy of resting for 3 weeks before that event. He came out a little rusty and it cost him in the long run, but I mean, golf is in a great place when you're going into a U.S. Open that's going to be as wide open of a U.S. Open championship in some time with this unknown commodity that is Chambers Bay and what awaits the players on Father's Day weekend. But you're going into that event with the three players that you mentioned, Jordan Spieth, Ricky Fowler, and Rory McIlroy as your three favorites. That's the kind of thing that gets television executives pretty happy when they see that that's coming up. And golf is in a very, very good spot with those three. And it's three guys who all do it differently. You know, Rory's kind of the machine with the chiseled swing and hits these incredibly long drives and these incredibly high irons. Jordan Spieth is the touch player that has a funny looking swing and finishes off balance half the time. He pulls the club back. And then you got Ricky Fowler, who's, you know, Mr. Style and adored by the fans, loved by the kids, and is looking to shed that image that he's got along with Allen. And it's just a great place for the game to be. All three of those guys are 20 or younger, of course, Steve, just 21. The smart money is still on Rory McIlroy to rate at St. Andrews for the Open Championship. And then, you know, who knows? You wide open, and that only makes me happy. Is a guy who's wondering who was going to come after Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson, the worry that golf would remain popular and the purses would stay this big and people would still be interested. Those three guys will keep people interested for a while.
You mentioned Tiger. Let's talk some Tiger Woods. It's hard not to when you discuss the world of golf. He's the reason I became a golf fan when I was younger, so I still feel that attachment even as he works his way into his early 40s. But I had to be encouraged by his Masters performance, which really came on the heels of some dreadful play, and I was especially scared about him on those tight fairways, the tight green complexes at Augusta. I was afraid he was going to blade chips all over the place, but it didn't really pan out. He came through there, and also I think seemed to be in a better place with his swing. And there's so much talk about Tiger's mentality and all that type of thing, but for me, it's always been the case of is his full swing down and set, and if it's not, then he's going to have a hard time because this is the highest level of golf. But I'm feeling pretty good about his work with Chris Como, and I think he's getting back to some of those older release patterns, as he calls it. It kind of gets a little wonky when he talks about his swing, but being a golf nerd like myself, I do enjoy that. But what are your feelings on Tiger's game, and can he be a threat this year in any one of the three remaining major championships?
Yeah, it's hard for me to see it happening again. I wouldn't have even thought that a year or two ago, and it's, in the swing work is true. I didn't like what was going on with Sean Foley. There was just, when you talk wonky jargon talk, man, the line of garbage that just came out of their mouths when they were talking about Tiger Woods' swing was overcomplication to a personification when he was working with Sean Foley there for a while. But the short game, which we all thought might be gone and might be an embarrassment, was fine at Augusta, and it was those full swings that if he can get back to a good place. But for me, the problem with Tiger isn't his swing getting to a place where he's comfortable. I think that even if Tiger plays pretty much exactly the way that he wants to play, he's just not the best anymore. And there was a while where he had a 2 or 3 shot lead stepping onto the first tee of the first round because he had that aura of invincibility around him. And since that aura of invincibility, and since Tiger Woods went from being some superhuman golfing specimen the Thanksgiving night with a fire hydrant, ever since that curtain came crashing down, he hasn't won a major championship. And of course, there have been the body breakdowns, which you can look back early in his career and see that violent athleticism that he swung with. And it's not hard to see now in hindsight that he wasn't going to be able to do that forever. But we didn't know it at the time. We just thought there was this comet flying across the sky that was something to behold, and we were lucky to watch it, which we were. But that's gone now. And I don't even think Tiger at his best, for what his best is going to be going forward, I just don't think anymore that that's going to be good enough to win major championships. Now, if it happens anywhere, you would look at the Open Championship at St. Andrews, a course where you don't necessarily have to hit it the farthest and the highest anymore, a place where he's won before and he knows well. Maybe you could see a venue like that suiting him pretty well. And I could be eating crow and he could end up breaking Jack's record within a matter of a few years, but the competition's better and he's quite simply not the best anymore. He doesn't hit it the highest. He doesn't hit it the furthest. And golf fans don't forget about this, but there was a 10-year period where Tiger Woods was the best putter and short game artist in the world as well, to go along with having the best swing and all the best tools. And that's just simply not the case anymore. And I wonder if it's good enough if his best would even be good enough anymore. And I personally think the answer is no. I'd love to be wrong because it's great for the game. I just don't see him competing and winning major championships anymore.
I think you make a great point. Tiger almost the victim, or I think he is the victim of his own success and his own way of doing things,
mm-hmm.
because you have emulators like Rory McIlroy who don't have 20 years of wear and tear on the tires and basically swing like Tiger and are as strong as Tiger Woods, are as good of an athlete as Tiger Woods. When Tiger came on the tour for the first time, it was a case of him having the edge in athleticism by far, and he was training in ways that athletes did, and at that time golfers weren't necessarily athletes, but now they are for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
You still see some outliers there, but there are, for a lack of a better term, so many Tiger Woods clones in the golfing universe, and not to say they all play the same way he does, but they have emulated his way to prepare, and it has paid off, and it has been fun to watch the newer generation rise up, and I'm especially excited about this year, like I mentioned, with the big three, maybe the new big three, at the top of the golfing world, and I hope it pans out. But there is that part of me that hopes that Tiger can get one or two major championships or at least be in contention on a Sunday. That would be a real blast, and maybe we'll see here at the new venue you mentioned, Chambers Bay, for the U.S. Open. One last thing for you, Mike, then I'll let you go. We're getting close to running out of time here on City of Champions Radio. But you mentioned Fowler, Spieth, McIlroy, guys who can make TV executives drool, waiting for the ratings to come in and seeing how many people tune in to follow those guys. Well, it's going to be a new network televising the U.S. Open. Fox takes it over, and we'll have Joe Buck and also Greg Norman on the call. So two really fresh voices, fresh faces, at least as far as golf is concerned, on television. How do you think that's going to pan out? Are you excited, or are you maybe looking back on the NBC days with a little bit of nostalgia already as we get ready to move into a new era in terms of at least the U.S. Open on TV?
I'm a little nervous about it, I guess. Sports taking over Premier League coverage, and they've done it beyond my wildest expectations. And don't get me wrong, I'm no Johnny Miller fan. I won't pine for the days of Johnny Miller talking about how he could have hit every single shot better than those tour pros actually executed the shot. I won't miss that. But Joe Buck, Greg Norman, well, those two might be fine. We've seen a couple of dry runs, if you will, for Fox Sports, and they've promised a lot of technological advancements, you know, more shot tracker, which is an idea that I love, more real distances, factoring in elevation and wind speeds and up-to-date graphics like that. But they've had an opportunity to try and give a little dry run to some of those. They have the U.S., the new amateur four-ball championships, which is a USGA event. They just kind of had a dry run showing those on Fox Sports 1, and a lot of the innovations that they promised weren't working properly are coming through. Now, maybe that's just a matter of working out some kinks, and that was the point of televising this event for the first time, but there were some hiccups definitely with the coverage at that point. Now, of course, a U.S. amateur four-ball championship is harder to televise than a U.S. Open because we don't know who any of these players are. You know, you don't know who, besides a couple of us in Western Pennsylvania, not only a lot of people know who Nathan Smith is competing in a four-ball championship,
mm-hmm.
so I'll give him a pass on that, but I will say I'm a little nervous about it. I'll give him the benefit of the doubt first, but I am coming in with some skepticism, to be sure. And to compound their troubles, Chambers Bay is a weird-looking place. I remember when they hosted it, when the U.S. Amateur was there 4 or 5 years ago, I remember catching some of it on the Golf Channel, and I remember thinking, I can't figure out what's going on this golf course. It looks like they're playing this thing on the surface of the moon. So, and that was the Golf Channel, who have some expertise in handling that. So not only is it a new team with a lot of technological things that they're going to have to work out while they're on the fly with the U.S. Open, it's just a weird venue for television that's going to make things a little more difficult. So I hope they handle it and get it figured out, because it wouldn't be bad to see some new changes and some updated televised golf coverage. But I'm coming at it with a little skepticism and kind of peeking between my eyes for the first couple of rounds to see how they handle it.
I'm a big Dan Hicks fan. I think he does a wonderful job with, with golf and the Olympics, too. He's had some awesome calls and some big moments, and that expect anything different call for Tiger Woods' putt in 08 at Torrey Pines is just an all-timer for me. It really causes the chills to go up and down my spine whenever I watch that replay. And I'm actually, I think, a bigger fan of Johnny Miller than most people. I appreciate that he speaks his mind. Yes, he can get grating and annoying at times, but I think he takes some risks, and still the only guy in televised golf who's not afraid to use the word choke, which does happen in the sport, and I feel like he's one of the few who's willing to address that. But Greg Norman, kind of an unknown entity, and Joe Buck, I think I was more on the fence about him, but I read an interview that he had with Golf Digest a couple of weeks ago, and I didn't realize he was that big of an amateur golfer. First of all, he's a pretty good player himself, and he really seems to have a passion for it. So I like Joe Buck's ability. I think we can sometimes fall into a case of Joe Buck overexposure with football and, of course, baseball on Fox. But I'm going to give it a shot. I'm coming in with an open mindset here. And like you mentioned, Father's Day weekend, so still a few weeks away. But one of the better events of the year in the world of sports. And that's my biased opinion. But I do love the U.S. Open above all else. So I'm looking forward to seeing how they present that. So, Mike, tell everyone listening where they can find you online, and also maybe what you've got ahead on Trib Live Radio, perhaps planned for this weekend.
Yeah, just either the App Store, the Android Store, the Apple Play, the Apple Store, the Trib Live Radio app. Just go ahead and download that right onto your phone. If you're listening at a desktop, you know, just go to sportstalk.triblive.com, the Tribune Review's website. You can easily find a link there, but the app is the easiest way to tune in. I host on some weekends, and I'll be doing a lot of what we've been doing here. Largely soccer and golf on Saturday mornings. I feel that they are drastically underserved topics in Pittsburgh sports media. I know a lot of people can talk about the Steelers and the Pirates and the Penguins with a lot more authority and knowledge than me, so I try to bring something a little different and always have a lot of fun, lively conversations on the weekends on Trib Live Radio, so I'd appreciate anybody tuning in.
And we can find you on Twitter at Michael Graw. I wanted to ask you, is that a German last name? I'm always interested in that type of thing, too.
It is indeed. Both of my dad's parents were a little outside of Stuttgart and met when they were taking an English language class in New Kensington, Pennsylvania, after they both emigrated. They grew up only a few miles apart and met in New Kent learning English after they emigrated. So, yep, hardcore German last name.
So, once again, Michael underscore G-R-A-U, and I made my first trip over to Germany last year to visit some of my wife's friends and absolutely loved it. So I'm looking forward to getting back over to there. And, Mike, thanks so much. I had a blast, and I know it's called City of Champions Radio, and we didn't really talk much Pittsburgh sports, but this is one of my more enjoyable podcasts of the year, I have to say. So thank you again.
Thank you very much, Matt. We'll see we'll talk to you on Saturday, I'm sure.
No doubt, as the Hounds get ready for another USL match, and that's where you can catch me on Trib Live Radio along with Mike and some other great Riverhounds guests if you're at all interested in Pittsburgh's pro soccer team. One last thing before we sign off, speaking of the Hounds, I want to thank Braxton Crisp for having me on WMUL-FM this week. My old college station at Marshall University. It was awesome to get back on there and preview Riverhounds and West Virginia Chaos. I mentioned the U.S. Open Cup begins for the Hounds with a second-round match against West Virginia. Wednesday night, 7 o'clock, head on down to Highmark Stadium to check it out. For Mike, this has been Matt on City of Champs Radio, reminding you that when the radio fades, you know life's moving fast. Have a great day, and we'll talk to you later in the week with Dan Cifo of the Latrobe Bulletin and DK on Pittsburgh Sports.